This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what's next for U.S. strategy in Syria? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On April 6th, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered a targeted military strike on an airfield in Syria in retaliation for a chemical weapons attack that killed more than 80 Syrian civilians. Mr. Trump, in his statement on Thursday night after ordering the attack, said he was, quote, moved by the horror of the beautiful babies who were cruelly murdered in this very barbaric attack, unquote. And in part, he blamed his predecessor's handling of the situation, which he said failed very dramatically. He was referring, of course, to President Barack Obama. However, just days earlier, members of the Trump administration were issuing contradictory statements about Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whom Mr. Trump recently called an animal. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had previously emphasized the administration's priority in defeating Islamic State forces in Syria and said little about the United States' preference on Assad's future. But UN Ambassador Nikki Haley said that the United States did not see a peaceful political resolution for Syria's civil war as long as Assad remains in power. Meantime, Secretary Tillerson held frank talks with President Vladimir Putin and his foreign minister Sergei Lavrov last week in Moscow. Washington blames Moscow for trying to shield their client Bashar al-Assad, on whose behalf they intervened militarily in September 2015. Moreover, Moscow rejects the U.S. intelligence assessment demonstrating Syrian culpability in the April 4th chemical assault. America, Britain, and France also reacted angrily as Russia vetoed a draft UN Security Council resolution condemning the recent chemical attack in Syria and demanding that Damascus cooperate with investigators. Well, with us to discuss to what extent the U.S. strikes on the Assad regime have or have not changed the dynamics of the Syrian conflict are two distinguished regional analysts. Jessica Ashu is Deputy Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Hussein Ibish, he's Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute, a policy group also based in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Well, Hussein Ibish, let me begin with you. Mm-hmm. Why do you think Donald Trump ordered this targeted military action by the United States, and do you think it represents a turning point in the conflict or perhaps just a one-off?
Well, I think it very much remains to be seen. The second question is easier to answer because we'll find out. You know, it depends on the follow-up. I think there were a number of reasons for the missile strike, and I think they range from personal to the grand strategic, in a sense. At one level, I think it's very hard not to see a personal angle here because President Trump's immediate underlings, Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, Nikki Haley, UN Ambassador Sean Spicer, the White House spokesman, had all said that the removal of Assad was no longer a priority for the United States in the days immediately leading up to the attack. So it's very hard to decouple the attack from the context of the administration easing its pressure on Assad. In a certain sense, Assad was baiting the United States. He was sort of making Trump complicitous, in a way, in this action. Also, by using sarin rather than chlorine, which he's been using all along, he was sort of mocking Washington because there was this agreement that Russia had brokered between Syria and the United States to give up sarin and stop using all chemical weapons. The international community sort of takes a different view of chlorine because it's a dual-use chemical. Everybody has chlorine for cleaning water and things like that. But when it comes to sarin, you're not supposed to have it. You're not supposed to possess it. Syria denied having it. Then they admitted having it but said they'd give it up. And so they had given it up, and then they went ahead and used it. So there's also that angle of the United States having to respond in order to reassert the inadmissibility of using chemical weapons and the inadmissibility of making an agreement with the United States and then mocking that agreement by murdering people with the very weapon that you supposedly repudiated and gave up.
That is very true. You said it very brilliantly. Let me turn to you, Jessica Ashu, for your take on the attack, to what extent it portends future shift in policy.
I think that Hussein is exactly right. And this was really a situation where Bashar al-Assad did it because he thought he could get away with it. And I think that the strike that President Trump ordered was very necessary because we know from the character of Bashar al-Assad how he has behaved over the 6 years of this war and how Vladimir Putin has behaved and continues to behave on the world stage. Is they both are people who will probe as far as they can go and see if they encounter resistance. And if they don't encounter resistance, they will just continue to go ahead and do it. And I think that it is no surprise that Bashar al-Assad had been, over the past several months, steadily recouping his chemical weapons program. This was not a one-off attack on his part. We had seen throughout March the accelerated use of chlorine gas as a chemical weapon, and we had seen potentially smaller sarin gas attacks earlier in March as well. So this was a classic case of Bashar al-Assad probing to see what he could get away with. And I think that the signal was received very strongly through President Trump's attacks that this behavior is not acceptable.
Turning back to you, Hussein Ambish, so he got the message, presumably Bashar al-Assad,
does not
preclude him from continuing to use barrel bombs, chlorine gas, and other conventional weapons to attack his own people.
Right.
So, again, not that this was not an important message to send, but of course the question is what's next and what is the role for Russia? Because Russia right now basically denies that Assad is responsible for having done the attack.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is fascinating to watch the Russians. I mean, you would expect the Syrian regime, the Iranians, Hezbollah, etc., most of the actors on the pro-regime side deny that. Russia cannot possibly defend the use of sarin in this way, and they have to deny. They have to, in fact, they have to say that it was the rebels or it was somebody else, and that's what they're saying. It's wholly unconvincing. The question of what comes next depends entirely on the extent to which this and other factors have made the Trump administration rethink its approach to Syria or move in a direction that's different than the initial impulse. I mean, the initial impulse was to try to find a way of working with Russia and possibly the regime to pursue a single isolated goal, which is the defeat of ISIL, the destruction of the caliphate, a so-called caliphate and whatnot, and that everything else in Syria was framed by President Trump's rhetoric during the campaign and the initial weeks of the administration as being about that, as if the only interest the United States had in Syria was ISIL, and that ISIL could be extracted from the other issues and dealt with on an ad hoc basis with whoever is willing to take up arms against ISIL, including potentially the regime. Now, this sarin attack, which was really a huge provocation against the United States for the reasons that I mentioned, has upended that. President Trump says that his attitude has changed completely. He didn't explain what it is now, but I mean, he certainly used to say to Obama in 2013, don't attack Syria after the initial use of sarin that killed 1,044 people that prompted the deal, and where he was very much against the United States getting involved deeper in Syria. But now you've got Secretary Tillerson saying there's no future for Assad. Assad family is on its way out. You've got Nikki Haley saying the war can't end as long as Assad is there. And you've got the rhetorical framework for a very different American approach, one that recognizes what the U.S. allies in the Gulf and Turkey, so Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, and the Turks as well, and probably Europeans, have been saying to Washington all along, which is you can't separate Assad and ISIL and everything and deal with them separately. First of all, Assad and ISIL are two sides of the same coin of vicious sectarian warfare. And secondly, everything in Syria is related to everything else. So you can't just deal with these things on an ad hoc basis. You've got to have a comprehensive policy. And that comprehensive policy is going to involve confronting Russia and Assad and Hezbollah and Iran about their behavior and the conduct that has led to these crises, including not just chemical weapons, but the huge number of displaced persons. Between one quarter and a third of Syrians have been displaced from their homes, and the deaths of maybe up to 500,000 people.
Indeed. Let me now turn to Jessica Ashu for your take, particularly with respect to Russia. They deny that Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, partly because it would be an acknowledgement that they have not held up their end of the bargain by brokering this agreement. Obviously, if they used sarin gas, that means that they are partly responsible. So they are playing a spoiler role. So that leads us to ask, does the United States have any leverage over Moscow after this strike as Moscow continues to deny this happened on the part of Bashar al-Assad, blaming the rebels with no evidence and basically criticizing the United States for the so-called crime of retaliating? We're really in a no-win situation, it seems.
Yeah, the mendacity of the Russians in this situation is really hard to overstate. It's embarrassing, almost, the way that they're behaving, because exactly as you said, any acknowledgement of the reality means that Moscow either was unwilling or unable to hold up its end of the bargain. And the interesting thing for me, however, is that while we've seen this typical response from the Russians, as Hussein has said, they try to obfuscate the reality in order to deflect any blame. But the actions of Bashar al-Assad are so indefensible on a global scale that the Russians are really the only ones who are willing to stand up publicly for him. Even the Iranians have been very, very quiet on this. And it's interesting when you consider Iran's history, because the use of chemical weapons is actually extraordinarily sensitive for the Iranian people, because they themselves were victimized by Saddam Hussein when he used chemical weapons against the Iranian population in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. So it just underscores how low Moscow has sunk in trying to rhetorically defend Bashar al-Assad. Now, the question of whether the United States has any leverage over the Russians, I think that they actually do. We've seen throughout the past several months and even throughout the course of the campaign that the Russians are really desperate to get American sanctions lifted. What they want is a deal with Washington to get the sanctions lifted. Their economy has been hurting a great deal. I mean, if you look at the fundamentals of the Russian economy, they're not sound. Their population is shrinking. They're being hammered by the low price of oil. And, you know, the Russian economy is smaller than the Italian economy, which really kind of puts Putin's situation into perspective. So I think, yes, through continued economic leverage, the United States has a great deal of pressure that it can exert over Moscow. Furthermore, I think that this strike was really effective in reclaiming some military prerogative in Syria for the United States, which is essential towards pushing this conflict towards a negotiated solution. I was a participant in the Geneva II negotiations in early 2014, and it was very frustrating because it was very, very clear that the regime was unwilling to make any concessions and the Russians were unwilling to push them towards any concessions because the reality on the ground was that they didn't have to. They were really just playing out the clock, and they knew that they had to just show up to the peace talks and that would be enough. And so this really changes the equation. And the important thing now is that pressure militarily needs to be kept on the Assad regime. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean further strikes, but it does mean the credible threat of military pressure. And there are a number of ways that the president could do that. I think that it would be very wise for him to go to Congress and try and get an authorization of the use of military force for Syria, not necessarily because he would use it, but because it would be a very strong signaling mechanism to Russia and the rest of the world that the United States government is actually very united on this issue and that they're not going to be able to exploit any political breaks in this country. Furthermore, it would be wise for the Trump administration because it would help them rebuild some of their relationships on Capitol Hill and both sides of Congress. So I can only see that as being a good thing.
And I think you wanted to add something.
I do. I slightly disagree in the sense that I think it's essential that somehow or another there's more kinetic action. It doesn't necessarily have to be by the United States, but it has to be supported and organized by the United States. The balance of power on the ground in Syria has got to shift. Right now, pro-regime forces, especially the forces of Hezbollah, have too much control over too much of the country in a pretty solid way. And that's got to be thrown into question. Right now, one of the impediments to getting to a political solution is that you've got at least four major actors on the regime side: the regime, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah. And they all kind of depend on and reinforce each other and hold each other back from making concessions because they all have slightly different interests and they all have skin in the game. I think you've got to start to break that coalition. You've got to start to change the incentive structures of the different actors, and you've got to weaken the grip, particularly the grip of Hezbollah, over crucial parts of Syria, because right now, especially Hezbollah, is sitting there on the ground in a very strong dominant position in key areas and saying, we have no incentive to compromise at all. In fact, we could double, triple, quadruple down here. The Russians are dependent on them. The regime is dependent on them. And they're even a non-state actor. So I think clearly this has got to be the starting point of a much broader campaign.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jessica Ashu. She's Deputy Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council, a think tank here in Washington, and Hussein Ibish, from whom you just heard. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And we're discussing U.S. strategy in Syria. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. Well, quickly back to you, Hussein Ibish. Just a quick question before I go back to Jessica on some of the recommendations she made. Do you think that the United States indeed does have leverage? I guess the big question is, will they use it with respect to sanctions, maintaining these sanctions on Russia, not ceding? And also, what about going to Congress for an authorization for military force? Okay. Would that send an important signal?
Well, first on the sanctions, I think the sanctions on Russia are going to be maintained, and they might even be intensified. The romance, the honeymoon between Russia and the Trump administration ended a lot sooner than most people thought. I mean, it was done for at least a month ago. So I think that's going to continue. And getting an authorization to use force might be important politically inside the United States. It might have an impact in Moscow, but it won't change the thinking of Iran or Hezbollah or the regime. And there, I think you need to start impacting the equation on the ground, more than sanctions, more than that congressional resolution, which might be important. That's a domestic political calculation, in my view.
Back to you, Jessica Ashu, for your comment on what's next, how you think, for example, the United States could change the calculus vis-a-vis Iran, Hezbollah. You know, we're hearing recommendations from analysts and others about the fact that this is just an opening salvo, that if the United States does want to make a difference, and as you have argued, that the United States needs to do more, perhaps, as Hussein suggested, provide greater support for non-extremist rebels on the ground. Are there any left, you know, is my question, create safe zones, perhaps destroy Syrian airfields or the air force, which they use then to either bomb civilians with barrel bombs or other conventional weapons?
All of the above, Carol. I agree with Hussein that creating leverage on the ground is going to be vitally important to ending this war. And it's really an escalate to de-escalate situation. And I think it's very, very important that anything that we do have a focus of civilian protection at its core. Because the reality is that groups like ISIS exist because of how poorly they have been treated by their government and by other actors. And so it makes it very easy for bad actors to come in and convince people that they are their only place to turn for protection. And that's just simply not the case. As to whether there are moderate rebels available to support, absolutely. You know, it makes me angry to see the trajectory of the Syrian civil war because it never had to get this bad. And it was really the moderate Syrians were really caught in an unfortunate catch-22. They didn't get any support because people said that they were weak, and they were weak because they were the only ones who were not getting any outside support. I think, you know, it's certainly a harder situation now, but I think that it is still possible to effect change in certain areas on the ground in Syria. And if you can establish these areas with some more stability, some more community governance, then that creates these pockets of civility that can then be used as leverage to try and expand expand and to totally undermine the Russian and Assad argument that they're fighting only terrorists. And the most important way to undermine that is by example.
How do you see it, Hussein Ibish? Because, again, doesn't this risk a direct military confrontation with Russia?
No, I don't think so. I don't think Russia is willing to go to war with the United States over Assad. I think the only real danger is a miscalculation on both sides or one or the other side that could be produced only precisely through the lack of clarity that an ambiguous stance produces. So what Jessica and I are both pointing to is the need for clarity, precisely for clarity in the United States that makes clear where exactly the United States is going and how it intends to get there. And I think neither the United States nor Russia are going to go to war with each other over Syria. We both have limited aims. They do overlap to some extent when it comes to ISIL. There are things to work with here. But we've got to change the operating assumptions and the strategic equation that the actors have been operating under. We're not going to get anywhere. And of course it can be done. The idea that the United States never had any options was always wrong, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in exactly the way that Jessica has explained. But more than that, to say that there's nothing that can be done in Syria was always to say essentially that time has stopped and that nothing else is going to happen. Because in fact, change always occurs. And so a country like the United States can impact whether it's going to be positive change or negative change from our point of view by what we do and don't do. And doing nothing at all, which was often what the Obama administration chose in effect, is itself an intervention when you're a power as evident in the Middle East as the United States is. Doing nothing is also doing something. All of this serves to incentivize the actors, and it doesn't take much to start changing their perspectives. And I think clearly the missile strike has begun that process, and you'll see its effects fairly quickly. And as long as it's not a one-off, and as long as we don't just slip back into pretending that doing nothing or minimal actions is somehow good for us because we've become terrified of our own shadows because of Iraq and Afghanistan, then I think we can certainly start to see progress pretty quickly.
But Jessica Ashu, this need for clarity, it's the very thing that we're not really seeing. The Trump administration has so far shown a lot of sort of either ambivalence or ambiguity with respect to their views. They change. One day Assad doesn't have to go. His fate will be decided by the Syrian people. The next day, we're attacking the Bashar al-Assad regime for having perpetrated a chemical weapons attack on his own people. So how do you see this going forward, given that we're getting mixed signals from the Trump administration?
I think that the administration is getting perhaps too much criticism for changing its policy because they're really responding to events, and that's what we would want them to do. I mean, I think that they're actually displaying a healthy amount of flexibility in relation to changing realities on the ground. While they have been perhaps unclear or a bit vague with their public messages, I think there's also reason to take this as a type of strategy on the part of the president. He has said many times before that he's not a person who tends to like to telegraph his intentions, and he likes to use strategic ambiguity to his favor in kind of tense negotiating situations. So I think we're probably seeing a certain degree of that. But more broadly, I think that we're watching the evolution of thinking of a very new president. And the reality is that the world looks very different from behind the desk in the Oval Office than it does from the campaign trail or anywhere else. And I think that they came into office with a very laser focus on the terrorism issue. And they're now realizing that, as you and Hussein said earlier, ISIS is only one part of the terrorism issue that we're facing in Syria. Hezbollah is very much a threat to regional stability and a threat to the United States and the friends of the United States. And the reality of that situation is that if you keep Bashar al-Assad in power, Hezbollah grows in strength, and that's not a good situation. It's not a situation that helps us with our terrorism problem.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Jessica Ashu. She's Deputy Director of the Middle East Strategy Task Force at the Atlantic Council, and Hussein Ibish, Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks, Carol. It was great.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
On this edition of the